This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Joyful, joyful.
Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. This is the show where we talk about spirituality and sexuality for our community.
And good evening and welcome to Spirit Lounge, and you're with Rev Joy.
And Tal, hello.
Hi, Tal's pressing all the buttons again. I'm glad it's you, my darling, not me, because I think I would just go to water, really.
I know how to press these buttons.
Now, we've got in our studio a very special guest tonight, and she's actually our boss here. So yes. We'll have to be on our best behaviour tonight, Tal. Have you got that?
Nope.
I like it when people say that.
Yeah, but we never do it, Emily.
Boss lady. It's wonderful to be here.
Now, Emily has selected the music tonight, so we thought we would start with a song about animals because Pope Francis has decided that animals are all going to heaven. Unlike the previous Pope who said that no animals went to heaven, we don't like him. Pope Francis, he received two donkeys for Christmas, Thea and Noah. And he was comforting a child whose dog had died. And so he made this decree that paradise is open to all God's creatures. But we were wondering if dogs who have bit people or done the wrong thing have to go to purgatory first, weren't we, Emily?
Are there rules for this?
I realised I was confused by this story, by the way. I thought it was saying that Pope Francis quoted the Apostle Paul when the Apostle Paul was comforting a child.
No.
Except, no. He was comforting, he was quoting Paul in order to comfort a child. I was like, ooh, that's a story I feel like I would have come across.
Can animals confess and then sort of know? Amend their ways?
Well, I'm sure they must be able to.
I think some can. Cats cannot.
Why?
That's because as much as I'm a cat person, they do not feel remorse. That's my
So they're just stuck in purgatory forever, is that the story?
Yes.
Okay. But anyway, what song are we going to start with based on the fact that all animals are now going to heaven?
Well, the Pixies were well ahead of the Pope. Back in the 1980s, they knew that monkeys gone to heaven.
Good evening, faithful listeners. You're listening to The Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9 every Thursday from 8 until 9. And if you want to come join the conversation with us, send us an SMS on 0427-JOY949. You can send us an email on onair@joy.org.au. You can also contact us through the app, and you can even...
ring Brian.
Yes, go ring Brian, and he'll pick up the phone and have a little chat.
He'll say, what do you want?
Yes.
No, you can bring Brian on 1-800-JOY-949 and he would love to talk to you and we'll send your message through to us. Our guest, as we said, is Emily. And Emily, how on earth did you end up teaching radio in Afghanistan?
Well, I started working in community radio way, way, way back in 1993. It kind of dates me. And I worked in different community radio stations and then for the ABC, and I worked in Singapore for 4 years as a correspondent. And I was freelancing a lot, but not making a lot of money. And so I saw an advertisement for a three-month job in Afghanistan setting up a radio station at the University of Herat. And I'd worked in two university-based community radio stations in Australia. So I thought, oh, yeah, I can do that. So I applied, and then 3 weeks later I was in Afghanistan wondering, oh, no, what have I done?
Did anyone else apply, do you know? or were you the only insane person?
There was one other person who applied, I think. Yeah.
Wow. And so tell us a little more about what exactly you were doing there, slash who with, and that sort of...
So I was working with a local non-government organisation that specialised in media development. So that meant going to different universities, different community groups, different towns in Afghanistan, and talking with them about their access to information and helping those communities to establish media facilities that allowed them to have a voice in their own futures. So the first project that I worked on was at the University of Herat. They had a journalism school as part of the university, but after two or three decades of conflict, there really wasn't much left of the university. I mean that quite literally. So there was no windows, no glass in the windows. The doors were broken in. The electrical wiring was very, very, very scary. And a lot of the professors who could have migrated as refugees to parts of Europe, Australia, and the United States had done so. And so the teaching staff were an odd bunch of some wonderful people, but the capacity was quite limited. And so my job was to go there to help physically set up the radio station, but then teach the university staff and students to run that facility for themselves.
So was there any equipment, or was there a basic studio already there?
There was nothing there before this NGO started working there. So the way that journalism had been taught in Afghanistan, and still is taught in a number of countries like Afghanistan, is a very theoretical way. And there's very little in the way of practical training, which of course means that when people actually go to practice journalism, they don't have that kind of skill set. And so you get a lot of very formalistic, dull kind of journalism that doesn't really engage with people. Yeah.
Is there freedom of the press over there? Or
in Afghanistan, surprisingly, perhaps, yes. So the time I went to Afghanistan from about 2004, and I lived there until 2008, and then I kept going there, working on different projects until 2014, so earlier this year. And the commitment of Afghan journalists to freedom of the press and to claim that right is really quite outstanding. Like any group of journalists, they fight amongst themselves, and there's a degree of competition between media organisations. But when the government tries to step in and impinge the rights of journalists, they get together very quickly to assert their rights. For a long time as well, I think perhaps because the reach of the central government was quite limited, it meant that journalists had a significant amount of freedom. So the kind of repression that journalists did feel was more based upon local warlords or power brokers who controlled different parts of Afghanistan and who were able to make people's lives very difficult. But there wasn't that kind of centralised repression of journalists that you might have seen in, say, Iran or Pakistan or, say, the former Soviet states to the north of Afghanistan.
So what were living conditions like for you?
For me, relatively good. I was living in an NGO compound, and we had a cook. Relatively good. So, I had a very bare room. The electricity was on for a couple of nights a week, if we were lucky, for 2 or 3 hours. So those kinds of reliance or access to basic services that you kind of just take for granted in Australia didn't exist. People brought care packages of food from Kabul or from overseas. So, if we wanted things like coffee, we had to bring that in. We had to fly that in ourselves. But those are very much relative deprivations compared to the living conditions of the people who live in Herat and have no opportunity to leave when they feel like it. The conflict, as in many other parts of Afghanistan, had torn apart families, led to people missing out on school, missing out on university. And despite that, people were, at least in those early days, 2004, 5, 6, very enthusiastic and very determined to try to make the best of their lives.
So could many people go on to university?
So many people had missed out on university, and because of the Taliban's rules about education, and because many people had missed out on high school, then they also had trouble completing the exams to get into university. So one of the interesting things about the university was that often we had such a massive age range. So we had people who were 16 years old, and we had people in their sort of mid-30s, all of people of about the same educational standard, but people who had missed out on different things at different parts of their lives. And we also had people who were 17 years old and married with two kids, or then because one of their parents had died, they had responsibilities for their whole family. And so you don't have that kind of youth sort of category that we have in Australia. Sort of young people go on a gap year vacation, and then they go to university and kind of muddle through their 20s, and maybe sort of, you know, finally decide to get their act together in their 30s. In Afghanistan, it kind of happens just like that.
Trouble so hard, don't nobody know my trouble but God. Don't nobody know my trouble but God.
And you're on Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9, and we've got Emily in the studio. Now, you chose that last track, Natural Blues. Tell us about that one.
Well, I chose that track for a quite, I guess, peripheral reasons to the conversation we're having. But when I was living in Afghanistan in 2004, there weren't many entertainment opportunities, and so we spent a lot of time watching DVDs. So I think I watched all 7 or 8 seasons of Sex and the City over one weekend at one point. And we spent an awful lot of time watching the BBC World Service, and the promo that they had for that service at the time, the tagline was Making Sense of It All, and they used that music from Moby as the background. And it's an interesting story. So there's a 1999 song, and it was an award-winning song for Moby, but sampled the work of Vera Hall in a 1937 song, Trouble So Hard.
Oh, wow. Now, you are in Afghanistan. How much does religion play a part in what people are allowed to do or say on radio over there, or in journalism in general?
Well, it's a fundamentally important part of the culture, and in some ways it's so important that it's almost unstated. It's always there in the background. And then at times it does come to the foreground. So, for example, every day when we started broadcasting, there would be a prayer. And now, whenever you have a public event in Afghanistan, there is always a prayer, and people would always be leaving the radio station to pray. And there are all kinds of days where we wouldn't have people for a whole variety of reasons. So, I mean, religion is fundamentally important and cuts across so much of life in Afghanistan. And I guess as a foreigner in Afghanistan, and as a foreigner working in international development in Afghanistan, that was something that you could totally have to take into account. But it was something that we tried to use to our advantage as well.
Now, a lot of foreign aid is often of a religious nature or somehow religiously affiliated. And do we see that as much in Afghanistan?
Not so much, no. Because I think there are the organisations that are working in international development that have some kind of religious or faith allegiance are very careful in Afghanistan to have that very, 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 very much in the background, lest they be accused of proselytising. And some NGOs in the early days in Afghanistan were accused of that, and that tends to lead to houses being invaded, being burned down, people being assaulted and killed, and forced to leave the country. So those organisations are usually extremely careful when they're working in Afghanistan. However, I think there are very positive ways that religion is used in the kind of work that non-government organisations are doing in the country. So a lot of my work was involved sort of behaviour change communication. And that sounds kind of manipulative in a way. So you could probably call it social change communication. So it might be something, for example, helping young people to have a greater role in community-based decision-making processes, or helping people to think about a different way that women may be able to live their lives in Afghanistan. Often religion was a progressive force in those campaigns. That Afghan culture is often very conservative, and while religion could be very conservative as well, depending on how the interpretation one had of Islam, the Quran, Hadith, you could actually often find quite liberal or progressive passages and justifications, and imams willing to support that work.
So, were there females at university?
Depends where you are in Afghanistan. So in the south, generally that was not the case. So in places like, where there are universities, in places like Kandahar and Horst, very, very rare. And indeed, it's somewhere like Horst, it was very rare to see women even sort of walking on the streets. So that the grocery shopping was done by the men, and women were very much literally in the house. In Kabul, it was a bit of a mixed bag. And the further north you went, generally, the opportunities for women to take part in education and public life increased. So in Herat, Bamiyan and Mazar-i-Sharif, there were, I guess, between about maybe sort of one third to one half the students at university were women.
Did the religious leaders play a role in the university at all?
I mean, there were religious faculties at the universities, and so that was a strong part of the universities. I remember when we first went to Herat to set up the radio station there, one of the things that the vice chancellor and the university leadership were most fearful of is that the students would say something that would get the university into trouble with the religious authorities. And so at the very beginning, when we were working with the students and producing the radio programs, everything had to be pre-recorded. All the programs, all the news, all the programs were pre-recorded, so that, and then a faculty member had to listen to everything before it went to air, because they simply didn't trust the students. Mm. And so one of the first things that we managed to achieve there was to help the faculty and the university trust the students a little bit more. Because one of the beautiful things about radio is doing what we're doing now, which is live radio. And, you know, of course, the students did make a few mistakes in the first few times they went live. But
oh, no.
The sky did not fall in, and the students learnt pretty quickly, and everyone started having more fun, and it was much better radio, and that started and continues to this day.
And I think it's quite amazing. I mean, I think it's fair to say that, you know, I mean, on top of the many sort of perceptions and issues that people have in Australia when it comes to Islam, on top of that, people would tend to say, well, unlike the more conservative type Islam of Afghanistan. But I think it's quite interesting that you're sort of pointing out that even on top of that, it's not so simple to try and then sort of say that Afghan Islam is particularly conservative or this, and that it's doing quite the opposite.
I mean, there are a range of viewpoints on Islam in Afghanistan. I mean, Islam's came to Afghanistan, at least some parts of Afghanistan, relatively recently. So Nuristan, which is a province in the east of Afghanistan, I think Islam came there in around about 1900. Nuristan. Wow. Nuristan is called Land of Light because they finally saw the light in around 1900. So different parts of Afghanistan have got different experiences of Islam. And as mentioned earlier, that in many ways Afghan traditional culture is more conservative and puts more constraints on women and different people in Afghan society than some religious leaders would put. And there is a lot of potential to interpret, especially hadith and different sources of teaching in Islam. And so often with the social change communication campaigns, for example, campaigns to encourage families to allow women to vote in the elections, the kinds of justifications for that could often be found in Islam, and there were imams who were quite happy to go on and say that. I mean, some of those people lose their lives because there are conservative elements, the Taliban amongst others. I mean, and there are many different groups within that group, which we call the Taliban. And so many of those people have been killed, along with many civilian leaders. But they continue to want to see an Afghanistan which is more progressive and liberal than we have today.
And you're on Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. What was that track, Emily? And why did you select it?
That track was by a Canadian singer-songwriter called Ray Spoon, who lived as a trans man for about a decade until they decided that the whole gender thing was just thoroughly misguided. And so they, along with a frequent collaborator, Ivan Coyote, now are genderless. And in fact, some people in Melbourne may have gone to the Tilda Film Festival about three or four weeks ago now, and there was a film, My Prairie Home, which was a sort of a biopic about the career to date of Ray Spoon. And Ray grew up in an evangelical family in Canada and survived it. So that song was about the family brother, about their brother, and how together they survived that family. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Now, we were talking about Afghanistan, and you were teaching radio there, but were you aware of an LGBTI community, knowing that you can't, you don't want to name anything or anyone?
Yeah, so I mean, not naming people or organisations or anything that could even allow anyone to be identified, even vaguely, yes. But very, 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 very underground. So to the point that as a trans woman now, I would feel uncomfortable about going back to Afghanistan. And as a foreigner in Afghanistan, you have a certain leeway that Afghans themselves don't have. But I'm just not sure it'd be a very good idea for me to be there. And from what I have seen of the trans community in Afghanistan, it is incredibly underground. I was aware of different organisations, and I won't even say what they did or what part of the country they're in, but which provided a safe haven. And so there are some organisations, for example, where women are able to meet. And often, because they're safe places and they're places that men don't go to, and the families are happy for women to go to those places. And there are, a few of those where there may have been people who went there for other kinds of safety as well.
But are they forced into marriage? You talked about how people of 17 are married with, might have a couple of kids by the time they get to university. So are LGBTI people having to marry?
I mean, that wasn't something that I studied in detail in Afghanistan. And my own kind of awareness of who I am and sort of coming out sort of came at the end of that period when I was in the country. But certainly, I think it's, as a generalisation, it's fair to say that people who are not married, who don't get married in Afghanistan, stand out.
Yeah. So you went also to Sri Lanka. What were you doing there?
So very similar kinds of work. So I worked in Sri Lanka, in Pakistan, in Malaysia, and some other countries in South and Southeast Asia. All projects which involved, I mean, very much like Joy does for the LGBTI community in Melbourne and Australia, to provide opportunities for people to be informed about what was going on in where they live, to empower those people, to entertain them as well. So in Sri Lanka, for example, we were working there toward the end of the civil war, when a large number of people from the north had been sort of interred in IDP camps / prisoner of war camps, or so / sort of prisoner camps, and they had sort of no idea about what was going to happen to them. Often they were separated from family members. They were a long way from home. They didn't know whether they'd be able to go home. They didn't know whether their jobs existed still. And so the organisation that I worked for produced radio programs and distributed newspapers that allowed those people to find out what was going on, to communicate with relatives, to try to reunite with relatives when they left the camps and so forth.
That's absolutely amazing. And I guess, to what degree do you have shows which are just much more mundane, I guess? Does that happen? Is there a place for joy in the...
It all sounds very serious, doesn't it?
Yes, but which is okay. I mean, I'm just wondering to what degree those sort of things happen. And
I think that that those serious things, that the information and the issues are very important, but for people in Afghanistan or Sri Lanka or Pakistan or anywhere in the world, I mean, who they're living their lives, and they're interested in a lot of the same kinds of things that we're interested in. So, you know, they're interested in, are their kids going to be able to go to school? But they're also interested in having a large screen TV mounted on the wall. And so, yes, I mean, entertainment is a huge part of the media in Afghanistan. There are commercial television networks, some in fact run by a couple of by some Australian family called the Massanis. So they run the biggest radio and television networks in the country, and entertainment is a huge part of their programming, particularly sort of Indian sort of soap operas, but increasingly Afghan material, often pushing the boundaries. And so those large media organisations in Afghanistan were often coming into conflict with parts of the conservative religious establishment who didn't believe that certain things should be talked about on air, or didn't believe that Afghans should be watching the kind of, you know, family dramas and sort of sexuality that one sees in Indian soap operas, for example.
So did you have lots of music, and what sort of music?
Lots of music, which of course is sort of was famously banned for many years in Afghanistan. I mean, that there are long and wonderful musical traditions in Afghanistan. Instruments, the names of which I can't remember, but there are. So there's those sort of traditional sort of classical Afghan musical traditions, and a strong telling of a strong tradition of storytelling through music. But then they also have, you know, their sort of 50s and 60s pop stars, and there's someone, there's one particular pop star whose name is not popping into my head, and if there are any Afghan listeners, I'm sure you know exactly who I'm talking about. And his, I'm pretty sure he was either passed or was sort of forced into exile, possibly both. But around Kabul and other parts of town, you still see these sort of posters, and his CDs and songs are still the most popular CDs and songs that people buy in Afghanistan. There's also a strong tradition of people in exile producing new music and sort of mashing up, you know, traditional Afghan musical styles with, you know, the styles of music, you know, where they've gone to live, be that Australia or the United States or elsewhere.
So were the young people, though, in Afghanistan creating new music?
So there, yes, is the short answer to that. And sort of one of the things I had the joy of taking part in Afghanistan was designing something called the Afghan Youth Voices Festival. And part of that was sort of young people getting involved in all kinds of creative media arts, including music making. There are music festivals. There are organisations which both are sort of helping young people to connect with the musical past of Afghanistan and those traditions. But then there's also a rock music festival where, you know, sort of contemporary musicians come to Afghanistan and work with young Afghans who want to sing, who want to, you know, play bass or lead guitar, who want to do their own, you know, rapping and hip-hop. And so there's a music festival, I think it's every year, and I think it's organised by musicians out of New York in the States, and they go there and conduct workshops, and they have a music festival and performances at the end of that.
Another reality is that more and more people from places like Afghanistan are moving to Australia as refugees or just as migrants. And on top of that, the reality is that I'm sure many of those people are sexually diverse, gender diverse people. So, I mean, we're a show that covers religious issues, and would you, from what you've seen there, would you have any idea about how we could, not necessarily reach out to them, it's not necessarily our sort of place, but have a sort of, what do we need to do to be able to sort of better communicate in these sort of backgrounds? So this is a bit of a tough question, to be fair, but...
Well, I think we're talking about a number of different communities there, and so in Melbourne on Monday, in fact, the Human Rights Law Centre conducted a forum that was looking at the particular kinds of challenges that are faced by LGBTIQ asylum seekers coming to Australia. And in fact, I mean, similar challenges in going to other countries as well. And it's interesting, the European Court of Justice just a few weeks ago came down with a ruling that said that countries within the European Union were no longer allowed to use sort of gay tests to try to assess whether people, because people are claiming asylum on the basis that they'll be discriminated against in their countries of origin because of their sexual or gender identity. And then so immigration authorities in different countries were coming up with tests that were quite investigative or invasive of people's privacy and lives to try to assess whether, you know, this was really the case. So those kinds of tests, I think, are now not okay in Europe. In Australia, from what I understand, the government has a fair amount of leeway in terms of how it can go about seeking information. The authorities have also in the past suggested that, you know, if people go back to their countries of origins but just sort of hide themselves or modify their behaviour, that well, then they can survive in their countries of origin, and so they don't need to be asylum seekers. And I think that's been struck down by a court in Australia. But there are particular concerns for people who are LGBTIQ asylum seekers. For communities in more general, I think one of the things that you sort of learn sort of traveling around the world is that, you know, there are so many different perspectives on things. Australia is an island. It is easy for us to sort of focus on ourselves, focus inwardly. And one of the wonderful things about traveling, and it is such a cliche, is that you are forced into situations where you're looking at people's cultures from their perspectives. And so if there's sort of one generic answer that I could give to your answer, Tal, it would be to try to look at the world through other people's perspectives and understand that it's not about, you know, people adapting to us and making sense to us. It's about all of us, regardless of which, you know, ethnicity, country, faith, tradition we belong to, trying to make an effort to understand people on their own terms.
Thank you very, very much. Hello, and you're listening to The Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9, and we've had a few people writing in to us, and there's one we wanted to mention again.
They actually email, they don't write. By the time they wrote and the letter got here...
I'm just saying, I mean, writes really? For collective. I'm not going to change it every time, depending on whether or not they texted or emailed.
They typed.
They wrote, okay. one of the here, it's actually an anonymous message here.
Oh, no wonder when
just,
you read it.
Yes, we're just mentioning, by the way, that M was coming in a little bit quiet, and that's quite all right.
That's because she's polite, not like us.
But that's great. Also, we always admire feedback on the Spirit Lounge. And the other thing, expanding on what the Pope had been talking about regarding people going to heaven, wanted to tell us that... their pussy is going straight to heaven because she's a good girl.
Well, we're happy about that.
Yes. So also wanted to tell us, and thank you very much.
I think I know who that is.
Oh, really?
I'm not going to say, but hello.
Do you think the cats deserve to go to heaven? You can't say anything else.
I'm not going.
We could get you in big trouble here, Emily. Now, you also have been to Malaysia. Why and how did that come about?
Well, I've been travelling to Malaysia on and off since 1996 for family reasons, but I was working there as well and doing similar kind of media development work that we've been talking about. One of the challenges faced in Malaysia is conflict, some would say growing conflict, between the ethnic communities, the majority Malay community, and the smaller Chinese and Indian communities in Malaysia. And across those ethnic divides map fairly neatly some religious divides as well. So by constitutional decree, all Malays are Muslims. And as it turns out, many Chinese are Christians, others Taoists and other faiths, but many of them are Christians, and many of the Indians are Hindus, of course. So, and there is quite a lot of conflict between those religious groups. In terms of ethnicity, there are widely differing opportunities for Malays and Chinese and Indians in terms of access to educational institutions, in terms of access to jobs in the public service. And a lot of the... And then there are some conflicts between the different faiths. And so in circumstances where One person someone has converted from Islam to something else, then often that the family might, when burying that person, claim, well, that didn't actually really happen. And there's a whole Sharia court system in Malaysia that sort of mirrors the civil court system. And of course, non-Muslims don't have standing in front of that court. And so families and religious authorities can go to a Sharia court where other people of other faiths don't have standing, and that Sharia court has often been coming to conclusions that increase the divide, increase the conflict, that prioritise Islam. Politically, also there's been a conflict between the major political parties, UMNO and PAS, a sort of a race to the bottom in a sense about who can be the most conservative. And so the project that I was involved in was one of sort of interfaith dialogue. And so, because there are organisations that are also trying to bridge some of those gaps, the Islamic Renaissance Front being one of them. Kind of sounds like they should be fighting, you know, with bazookas and things, but yeah. They're one of the most interesting progressive organisations in this space in Malaysia. Very involved in bringing young people together from those different faith and ethnic communities. Because often they don't mix very much, and so there are prejudices which are based on sort of long-standing, you know, beliefs, or you know, just the fact that people don't communicate very much. And so when people do come together, think, oh, so you think that, and I think that, we've actually got more in common than we realise.
So was that supported by the religious leaders, or are they a bit sus about it? Or
different religious leaders supported it more than others. And so one of the big challenges in that project was finding a group that had that could talk with the more conservative parts of the Islamic community, and that had credibility with those people, but that was also interested in interfaith dialogue, interested in coming together with Christian and Hindu and other groups in Malaysia. So often the extremes felt that for political reasons or other reasons that they couldn't do that, but through an intermediary that they could. And so those sort of groups in the middle, like the Islamic Renaissance Front, are critically important.
I've always noticed with interfaith is that often even those that seem to be the difficult ones that you can't reach, that to some degree what happens is interfaith happens without them, and religious groups don't like things to happen without them, and so over time they do find alternative roundabout ways to somehow be involved. Hopefully that's usually the case.
Yeah, in Malaysia the government tries to control the interfaith exchanges as well, so they have an interfaith commission, I think it's called interfaith commission, that's sort of like the official version of interfaith relations, which which I think some of the non-Islamic groups don't have a lot of faith in, and think is basically set up to maintain the status quo rather and to kill off the potential for real, you know, authentic dialogue and replace that with a very constrained and artificial form of interfaith dialogue. So you have sort of competition even within that interfaith space. Yeah.
Is there any sort of, I mean, we have religions here that claim that they have all the answers, that they're the right one, and so they try and convert everyone over to their religion. Is there any of that that goes on?
In Malaysia, or
yeah,
it was my impression that it's like in Malaysia is a good example where that doesn't happen very much, precisely because of sort of government and legal issues. Like as you, it was my like what you say. I think it's like, you know, literally illegal for someone to convert out of Islam, you know, as a Malay.
That's correct. And in Malaysia, things are really quite, in some ways, very conservative. So one of the big debates recently, or maybe over the last decade or so, is that non-Muslims are not allowed to use the word Allah in referring to God. And so this is a problem for example, Christian denominations who have Bibles in Malay language, because the word that they would naturally use for God in those Bibles is Allah, and the Malaysian religious authorities are saying, well, no, you can't do that. And I think that's the only country in the world where that's the case. So across the waters in Indonesia, it's not the case, and I don't think it's the case anywhere in the Middle East either. So it's interesting that in Malaysia, There are some very different views about and quite conservative views that sort of separate people of the Islamic faith from other faith traditions.
And you're on Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. After all this travel, Betty wants to know, and it's fair enough, you've gone from Afghanistan to Malaysia to all sorts of different places and then come back to Australia. How do you go moving through all those cultures and then settling down in Australia? And do you still have the travel bug?
I know many people who have done this kind of work and come back to Australia and then essentially bounced back out. It can be really difficult to settle back down in Australia. There are so many wonderful things about living here, but we are off in one little corner of the world, a long way away from a lot of other places. And there is also a sort of an adrenaline sort of drug rush that comes from being in some of these countries. It's a pressure cooker kind of environment, and it's also very easy to start to imagine that you're actually very, very important. You know, you're sort of helping people do things, and they need your help. And so where you come back to Australia, and all of a sudden you're a small fish in a big pond, whereas in some of these countries you can very easily sort of become a big fish in a small pond. It is difficult. I mean, I think coming out of Afghanistan, I probably had a very, very sort of mild kind of PTSD, because you, even living in a place like Kabul, it's not like you're at the pointy end. So it's not like being in Oruzgan or some of the other places where the fighting was really, really, really bad pretty much all the time. But there is always, in the back of your mind, there's always the risk that something might happen. You could be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And so you're kind of always sort of vaguely aware of sort of what would you do in that situation. And so it's that sort of constant kind of awareness of where you are that kind of slowly eats away. And so people slowly, slowly, slowly go crazy. So I think after 4 years, I was well and truly ready to leave Afghanistan. I think anyone who stays there much longer than that either stays there for life and sort of becomes that person, or you really have to get out and sort of readjust.
Well, Emily, thank you so much for coming on Spirit Lounge. And it's good night from Rev Joy.
And good night from Tal.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.